on her thigh where the skin had been taken for her graft, or to bang against the snakeskin-like scar on her other leg, even though she kept that one covered with a pressure bandage. But as she kissed me, my body had begun waking up to her, and with it, my mind had gone too. We laid down on my futon, but then, right as things had gotten going, she'd started crying. I couldn't tell at first, because the little sobs had sounded just the same as the little moans she'd been giving off moments before. But soon they'd grown in intensity, something awful and animal coming from deep within her. I'd asked if I'd hurt her, but she said that wasn't it and asked me to leave the room. When she'd come out fully dressed, she'd asked to go home. She tried to start things up with me once more after that, a summer night a few weeks before she'd left for Juilliard. Her grandparents had gone away to visit her Aunt Diane, so we'd had the house to ourselves for the night, and Mia had suggested we sleep in one of the upstairs bedrooms, since by then the stairs were no longer a problem for her. It had been hot. We'd opened the windows and kicked off the antique quilt and just gotten under the sheet. I remember feeling all self-conscious, sharing a bed with her after all that time. So I'd grabbed a book for myself, then propped up a row of pillows for Mia to bolster her leg against, like she liked to at night. "I'm not ready to sleep," she'd said, running a finger down my bare arm. She'd leaned in to kiss me, not the usual dry peck on the lips, but a deep, rich, exploring kiss. I'd started to kiss her back, but then I'd remembered that night at the House of Rock, the sound of her animal keening, the look of fear in her eyes when she'd come out of the bedroom. No way was I sending her down that wormhole again. No way was I going down that wormhole again. That night in San Francisco, though, with Viv's hand playing on the small of my back, I was raring to go. I spent the night with her at her apartment, and she came with me the next morning to have breakfast with the band before we took off for our next stop. "Call me next time you're in town," she whispered in my ear as we parted ways. "Back on the horse, my man," Fitzy said, high-fiving me as we piloted the band south. "Yeah, congratulations," Liz said, a little sadly. "Just don't rub it in." Sarah had recently finished law school and was working for a human rights organization. No more dropping everything to be Liz's plus one on tours anymore. "Just because you and Mikey are all tied down, don't come sobbing to us," Fitzy said. "Tour time is playtime, right, Wild Man?" "Wild Man?" Liz asked. "Is that how it's gonna be?" "No," I said. "Hey, if the name fits," Fitzy said. "Good thing I hit Fred Meyer for the economy box of condoms before we left." In L.A. there was another girl waiting, and in San Diego, another. But none of it felt skeevy. Ellie, the girl in L.A., was an old friend, and Lena, the one in San Diego, was a grad student, smart and sexy and older. Nobody had any illusions that these flings were leading to grand romance. It wasn't until our second-to-last gig that I met a girl whose name I never did catch. I noticed her from the stage. She locked eyes on me the entire set and wouldn't stop staring. It was weirding me out, but also building me up. I mean, she was practically undressing me with her eyes. You couldn't help but feel powerful and turned on, and it felt good to be so obviously wanted again. Our label was throwing us a CD release party after the show, invitation only. I didn't expect to see her there, but after a few hours, there she was, striding up to me in an outfit that was half hooker, half supermodel. Skirt cut up to there, boots that could double as military-grade weaponry. She marched right up to me and announced in a not-too-quiet voice, "I've come all the way from England to fuck you." And with that, she grabbed my hand and led me out the door into her hotel room. The next morning was awkward, like none of the morning afters had been. I did a walk of shame to the bathroom, quickly dressed and tried to slip out, but she was right there, packed and ready to go. "What are you doing?" I asked.
"Coming with you?"
she said, as though it was obvious.
"Coming with me where?"
"To Portland, love."
Portland was our last show and a sort of homecoming as we'd all be basing there now. Not in a communal House of Rock anymore. Liz and Sarah were getting their own place. Mike was moving in with his girlfriend, and Fitzy and I were running a house together. But we were all still in the same area, within walking distance to one another and the rehearsal space we now rented. "We're in a van, not a tour bus," I told her, looking down at my Converse. and Portland's the last show, a kind of friends and family thing. You shouldn't come. And you are not my love. She frowned and I'd slunk out the door, thinking that was the last of it. But when I showed up to soundcheck in Portland, she was there, waiting for me in the Satyricon. I told her to leave, not very nicely. It was along the lines of, there's a name for this, and it's called stalking. I was a dick, I know, but I was tired. I'd asked her not to come, and she was freaking me out in a big way. Not just her. 4 girls in 2 weeks was doing my head in. I needed to be alone.
Piss off, Adam. You're not even a bloody rock star yet, so stop acting like such a self-important wanker. And you weren't even that good.
This she shouted in front of everyone. So I had the roadies throw her out. She left screaming insults about me, my sexual prowess, my ego.
Wild man indeed, Liz said, raising an eyebrow.
Yeah, I said, feeling like the opposite of a wild man, actually wanting to sneak into a room and hide. I didn't know it yet, but once the real tour started, the one our label sent us on after the album went haywire, a 5-month slog of sold-out shows and groupies galore, all I'd wanted to do was hide. Given my isolationist tendencies, you'd think I'd have learned to stay away from the freebie affection on such constant offer. But after shows, I craved connection. I craved skin, the taste of another woman's sweat. If it couldn't be hers, well, then anyone's would do, for a few hours. But I'd learned one lesson. No more overnight guests. So that night in Seattle may have been the first time I became a guy. But it wasn't the last.
Chapter 14. The boogeyman sleeps on your side of the bed. Whispers in my ear, better off dead. Fills my dreams with sirens and lights of regret. Kisses me gently when I wake up in a sweat. Boo. Collateral damage, track 3. I go with Mia to the ferry anyway, because what else am I going to do? Throw a tantrum because she hasn't kept an up-to-date catalog of every conversation we've ever had? It's called moving on. And she's right about the ferry being dead. At 4:30 in the morning, not a lot of demand for Staten Island. There may be a dozen people sprawled out in the downstairs deck. One trio of late-night stragglers is sacked out on a bench, rehashing the evening. But as we pass them, one of the girls lifts her head and stares at me. Then she asks her friend,
"Dude, is that Adam Wilde?"
The friend laughs.
"Yeah, and next to him is Britney Spears. Why the hell would Adam Wilde be on the Staten Island Ferry?"
I'm asking myself the same question. But this is apparently one of Mia's things, and this is her farewell to New York, even though I'm not actually leaving to her. So I follow her upstairs to the bow of the boat near the railing. As we pull away from New York, the skyline recedes behind us, and the Hudson River opens up to one side, the harbor to the other. It's peaceful out here on the water. Quiet, except for a pair of hopeful seagulls following in our wake, squawking for food, I guess, or maybe just some company in the night. I start to relax in spite of myself. And after a few minutes, we're close to the Statue of Liberty. She's all spotlit in the night, and her torch is also illuminated, like there's really a flame in there, welcoming the huddled masses. "Yo, lady, here I am." I've never been to the Statue of Liberty. Too many crowds. Aldous once invited me on a private helicopter tour, but I don't do choppers. But now that she's right here, I can see why this is on Mia's list. In pictures, the statue always looks kind of grim, determined. But up close, she's softer. She has a look on her face, like she knows something you don't.
"You're smiling," Mia says to me.
And I realize I am. Maybe it's being granted a special pass to do something I thought was off limits. Or maybe the statue's look is contagious.
"It's nice," Mia says. "I haven't seen it in a while."
"It's funny," I reply. "Because I was just thinking about her." I gesture toward the statue. "It's like she has some kind of secret. A secret to life." Mia looks up.
"Yeah, I see what you mean."
I blow air out my lips. I could really use that secret. Mia tilts her head out over the railing.
"Yeah? So ask her for it."
"Ask her?
She's right there. No one's here. No tourists crawling around her feet like little ants. Ask her for her secret."
"I'm not going to ask her.
You want me to do it? I will, but it's your question, so I think you should do the honors.
You make a habit of talking to statues?
Yes, and pigeons. Now, are you going to ask?
I look at Mia. She's got her arms crossed across her chest, a little impatient. I turn back to the railing. Statue? Oh, Statue of Liberty? I call out quietly. No one is around, but this is still really embarrassing.
Louder,
Mia prods. What the hell?
Hey, excuse me,
I call out.
What's your secret?
We both cock our ears out over the water, as though we expect an answer to come racing back.
What did she say?
Mia asks. Liberty.
Liberty, Mia repeats, nodding in agreement. No, wait, I think there's more. Hang on.
She leans out over the railing, widening her eyes.
Aha.
She turns to me.
Apparently, she isn't wearing any underwear under her robes, and with the bay breeze, it provides a certain frisson.
Lady Liberty's going commando,
I say. That is so French. Mia cracks up at that.
Do you think she ever flashes the tourists?
No way.
Why do you think she has that private little look on her face? All those red state Puritans coming by the boatload, never once suspecting that old Libs hasn't got panties on. She's probably sporting a Brazilian.
Okay, I need to lose that visual,
Mia groans.
And might I remind you that we're from a red state? Sort of.
Oregon's a divided state, I reply. Rednecks to the east, hippies to the west.
Speaking of hippies and going commando... Oh no, now that's a visual I really don't need.
Memory Liberation Day!
Mia crows, referring to some 60s holdover in our town. Once a year, a bunch of women spend the day topless to protest the inequity that it's legal for men to go shirtless, but not women. They do it in the summer, but Oregon being Oregon, half the time it's still freezing. So there was a lot of aging, puckered flesh. Mia's mom had always threatened to march. Her dad had always bribed her with a dinner out at a fancy restaurant not to.
Keep your Class B misdemeanor off my B cups,
Mia says, quoting one of the movement's more ridiculous slogans between gasps of laughter.
That makes no sense. If you're bearing your boobs, why a bra?
Sense? It was some stoner hippie idea and you're looking for logic?
Mammary Liberation Day,
Mia says, wiping away the tears.
Good old Oregon. Oh, that was a lifetime ago.
And it was. So the remark shouldn't feel like a slap, but it does. How come you never went back? I ask. It's not really Oregon's abandonment, I want explained, but it seems safer to hide under the big green blanket of our state.
Why should I?
Mia asks, keeping her gaze steady over the water. I don't know. The people there?
The people there can come here.
To visit them, your family, at the... Oh, shit, what am I saying?
You mean the graves?
I just nod.
Actually, they're the reason I don't go back.
I nod my head. Too painful. Mia laughs, a real and genuine laugh, a sound about as expected as a car alarm in a rainforest.
No, it's not like that at all. She shakes her head. Do you honestly think that where you're buried has any bearing on where your spirit lives?
Where your spirit lives?
Do you want to know where my family's spirits live?
I suddenly feel like I'm talking to a spirit, the ghost of rational Mia.
They're here,
she says, tapping her chest.
And here,
she says, touching her temple.
I hear them all the time.
I have no idea what to say. Were we not just making fun of all the new agey hippie types in our town 2 minutes ago? But Mia's not kidding anymore. She frowns deeply, swivels away.
Never mind.
No, I'm sorry.
No, I get it. I sound like a rainbow warrior, a freak, a Looney Tune.
Actually, you sound like your gran. She stares at me.
If I tell you, you'll call the guys with the straitjackets.
I left my phone at the hotel.
Right.
Also, we're on a boat.
Good point.
And if by chance they do show up, I'll just offer myself up. So, what, do they, like, haunt you? She takes a deep breath and her shoulders slump as if she's setting down a heavy load. She beckons me over to one of the empty benches. I sit down next to her.
Haunt is not the right word for it. Haunt makes it sound bad, unwelcome. But I do hear them, all the time.
Oh.
Not just hear their voices, like the memory of them, she goes on. I can hear them talk to me, like now, in real time, about my life.
I must give her a weird look, because she blushes.
I know, I hear dead people, but it's not like that. Like, remember that crazy homeless woman who used to wander around the college campus claiming she heard voices broadcast to her shopping cart?
I nod. Mia stops for a minute.
At least, I don't think it's like that, she says. Maybe it is. Maybe I am nuts and just don't think I am because crazy people never think they're crazy, right? But I really do hear them. Whether it's some kind of angel force like Gran believes, and they're up in some heaven on a direct line to me, or whether it's just the them I've stored inside me, I don't know. And I don't know if it even matters. What matters is that they're with me, all the time. And I know I sound like a crazy person mumbling to myself sometimes, but I'm just talking to Mom about what skirt to buy, or to Dad about a recital I'm nervous about, or to Teddy about a movie I've seen. And I can hear them answer me, like they're right there in the room with me, like they never really went away. And here's what's really weird. I couldn't hear them back in Oregon. After the accident, it was like their voices were receding. I thought I was going to totally lose the ability to remember what they even sounded like. But once I got away, I could hear them all the time. That's why I don't want to go back. Well, one of the reasons. I'm scared I'll lose the connection, so to speak.
Can you hear them now? She pauses, listens, nods. What are they saying?
They're saying it's so good to see you, Adam.
I know she's sort of joking, but the thought that they can see me, keep tabs on me, know what I've done these last 3 years, it makes me actually shudder in the warm night. Mia sees me shudder, looks down.
I know, it's crazy. It's why I've never told anyone this. Not Ernesto, not even Kim.
No, I want to tell her. You got it wrong. It's not crazy at all. I think of all the voices that clatter around in my head, voices that I'm pretty sure are just some older or younger or just better versions of me. There have been times when things have been really bleak that I've tried to summon her, to have her answer me back, but it never works. I just get me. If I want her voice, I have to rely on memories. At least I have plenty of those. I can't imagine what it would be like to have had her company in my head. The comfort that would have brought. To know that she's had them with her all this time, it makes me glad. It also makes me understand why, of the two of us, she seems like the sane one. Chapter 15. I'm pretty sure that when babies are born in Oregon, they leave the hospital with birth certificates and teeny tiny sleeping bags. Everyone in the state camps. The hippies and the rednecks, the hunters and the tree huggers, rich people, poor people, even rock musicians, especially rock musicians. Our band had perfected the art of punk rock camping, throwing a bunch of crap into the van with like an hour's notice and just driving out into the mountains where we drink beer, burn food, jam on our instruments around the campfire, and sack out under the open sky. Sometimes on tour back in the early hard scrabble days, we'd even camp as an alternative to crashing in another crowded, roach-infested rock and roll house. I don't know if it's because no matter where you live, the wilderness is never that far off, but it just seemed like everyone in Oregon camped. Everyone that was, except for Mia Hall. I sleep in beds, was what Mia told me the first time I invited her to go camping for a weekend. To which I'd offered to bring one of those blow-up air mattresses, but she'd still refused. Kat had overheard me trying to persuade Mia and had laughed. Good luck with that, Adam, she'd said.
Denny and I took Mia camping when she was a baby. We planned to spend a week at the coast, but she screamed for 2 days straight and we had to come home. She's allergic to camping.
It's true, Mia had said.
I'll go,
Teddy had offered.
I only ever get to go camp in the backyard.
Gramps takes you out every month, Denny had replied. And I take you. You just don't get to go camping with all of us as a family. He'd given Mia a look. She'd just rolled her eyes back at him. So it shocked me when Mia agreed to go camping. It was the summer before her senior year of high school and my first year of college, and we'd hardly seen each other. Things with the band had really started heating up, so I'd been touring for a lot of that summer, and Mia had been away at her band camp and then visiting relatives. She must have been really missing me. It was the only explanation I could imagine for her relenting. I knew better than to rely on the punk rock mode of camping, so I borrowed a tent and one of those foam things to sleep on, and I packed a cooler full of food. I wanted to make everything okay, though, to be honest, I wasn't really clear on why Mia was so averse to camping in the first place. She was not a prissy chick, not by a long shot. This was a girl who liked to play midnight basketball, so I had no idea if the creature comforts would help. When I went to pick her up, her whole family came down to see us off, like we were heading off on a cross-country road trip instead of a 24-hour jaunt. Kat waved me over.
What'd you pack for food? She asked.
Sandwiches, fruit, for tonight hamburgers, baked beans, s'mores. I'm trying for the authentic camping experience.
Kat nodded, all serious.
Good. Though you might want to feed her the s'mores first if she gets cranky. Also, I packed you some provisions.
She handed me a half-gallon Ziploc.
In case of emergency, break glass.
What's all this stuff?
Now and Laters, Starburst, Pixie Sticks. If she gets too bitchy, just feed her this crap. As long as the sugar high is in effect, you and the wildlife should be safe.
Well, thanks. Kat shook her head.
You're a braver man than I. Good luck.
Yeah, you'll need it, Denny replied. Then he and Kat locked eyes for a second and started cracking up. There were plenty of great camping spots within an hour's drive, but I wanted to take us somewhere a little more special. So I wound us deep into the mountains, to this place up an old logging road I'd been to a lot as a kid. When I pulled off the road onto a dirt path, Mia asked, "Where's the campground?"
"Campgrounds are for tourists. We free camp."
"Free camp?" Her voice rose in alarm. "Relax, Mia. My dad used to log around here. I know these roads. And if you're worried about showers and stuff..."
"I don't care about the showers."
"Good. Because we have our own private pool." I turned off my car and showed Mia the spot. It was right alongside the river, where a small inlet of water pooled calm and crystal clear. The view in all directions was unfettered, nothing but pine trees and mountains, like a giant postcard advertising Oregon.
"It's pretty,"
Mia admitted, grudgingly.
"Wait till you see the view from the top of the ridge. You up for a walk?"
Mia nodded. I grabbed some sandwiches and waters and two packs of watermelon now and laters, and we traipsed up the trail, hung out for a while, read our books under a tree. By the time we got back down, it was twilight. "I'd better get the tent up," I said.
"You need some help?"
"No, you're the guest. You relax, read your book or something."
"If you say so."
I dumped the borrowed tent pieces on the ground and started to hook up the poles. Except the tent was one of those newfangled ones, where all the poles are in one giant puzzle piece, not like the simple pup tents I'd grown up assembling. After half an hour, I was still struggling with it. The sun was dipping behind the mountains, and Mia had put down her book. She was watching me, a bemused little smile on her face.
"Enjoying this?" I asked, perspiring in the evening chill.
"Definitely. Had I known this was what it would be like, I would have agreed to come ages ago."
"I'm glad you find it so amusing."
"Oh, I do. But are you sure you wouldn't like some help? You'll need me to hold a flashlight if this takes much longer."
I sighed, held my hands up in surrender. "I'm being bested by a piece of sporting goods."
"Does your opponent have instructions?"
"It probably did at some point." She shook her head, stood up, grabbed the top of the tent.
"Okay, you take this end, I'll do this end. I think the long part loops over the top here.
10 minutes later, we had the tent set up and staked down. I collected some rocks and some kindling for a fire pit, and got a campfire going with the firewood I'd brought. I cooked us burgers in a pan over the fire, and baked beans directly in the can.
I'm impressed, Mia said.
So you like camping?
I didn't say that,
she said, but she was smiling. It was only later, after we'd had dinner and s'mores, and washed our dishes in the moonlit river, and I'd played some guitar around the campfire, as Mia sipped tea and chowed through a pack of Starburst, that I finally understood Mia's issue with camping. It was maybe 10 o'clock, but in camping time, that's like 2 in the morning. We got into our tent, snuggled into the double sleeping bag. I pulled Mia to me. Want to know the best part about camping? I felt her whole body tense up, but not in the good way.
What was that?
She whispered.
What was what?
I heard something, she said.
It was probably just an animal, I said. She flicked on the flashlight.
How do you know that?
I took the flashlight and shined it on her. Her eyes were huge.
You're scared?
She looked down and barely nodded her head.
The only thing you need to worry about out here is bears, and they're only interested in the food, which is why we put it all away in the car, I reassured her.
I'm not scared of bears, Mia said disdainfully.
Then what is it?
I just feel like such a sitting target out here.
Sitting target for who?
I don't know. People with guns. All those hunters.
That's ridiculous. Half of Oregon hunts. My whole family hunts. They hunt animals, not campers.
I know,
she said in a small voice.
It's not really that either. I just feel defenseless. It's just, I don't know. The world feels so big when you're out in the wide open. It's like you don't have a place in it when you don't have a home.
Your place is right here, I whispered, laying her down and hugging her close. She snuggled into me.
I know, she sighed.
What a freak. The granddaughter of a retired Forest Service biologist who's scared of camping.
That's just the half of it. You're a classical cellist whose parents are old punk rockers. You're a total freak, but you're my freak. We lay there in silence for a while. Mia clicked off the flashlight and scooted closer to me.
Did you hunt as a kid?
She whispered.
I've never heard you mention it.
I used to go out with my dad, I murmured back. Even though we were the only people within miles, something about the night demanded we speak in hushed tones. He always said that when I was 12, I'd get a rifle for my birthday and he'd teach me to shoot. But when I was maybe 9, I went out with some older cousins, and one of them loaned me his rifle. And it must have been beginner's luck or something, because I shot a rabbit. My cousins were all going crazy. Rabbits are small and quick and hard for even season hunters to kill, and I'd hit one on my first try. They went to get it so we could bring it back to show everyone and maybe stuff it for a trophy. But when I saw it all bloody, I just started crying. Then I started screaming that we had to take it to a vet, but of course it was dead. I wouldn't let them bring it back. I made them bury it in the forest. When my dad heard, he told me that the point of hunting was to take some sustenance from the animal, whether we eat it or skin it or something. Otherwise, it was a waste of a life. But I think he knew I wasn't cut out for it, because when I turned 12, I didn't get a rifle. I got a guitar.
You never told me that before, Mia said.
Guess I didn't want to blow my punk rock credibility.
I would think that would cement it, she said.
Nah, but I'm emo core all the way, so it works. A warm silence hung in the tent. Outside, I could hear the low hoot of an owl echo in the night. Mia nudged me in the ribs.
You're such a softy.
This from the girl who's scared of camping, she chuckled. I pulled her closer to me, wanting to eradicate any distance between our bodies. I pushed her hair off her neck and nuzzled my face there. Now you owe me an embarrassing story from your childhood, I murmured into her ear.
All my embarrassing stories are still happening, she replied.
There must be one I don't know. She was silent for a while. Then she said,
Butterflies.
Butterflies?
I was terrified of butterflies.
What is it with you and nature?
She shook with silent laughter.
I know, she said. And can there be a less threatening creature than a butterfly? They only live like 2 weeks. But I used to freak any time I saw one. My parents did everything they could to desensitize me. Bought me books on butterflies, clothes with butterflies, put up butterfly posters in my room, but nothing worked.
Were you, like, attacked by a gang of monarchs? I asked.
No, she said. Gran had this theory behind my phobia. She said it was because one day I was going to have to go through a metamorphosis, like a caterpillar transforming into a butterfly, and that scared me. So, butterflies scared me.
That sounds like your Gran. How'd you get over your fear?
I don't know. I just decided not to be scared of them anymore, and then one day, I wasn't.
Fake it till you make it.
Something like that.
You could try that with camping.
Do I have to?
Nah, but I'm glad you came. She'd turned to face me. It was almost pitch black in the tent, but I could see your dark eyes shining.
Me too. But do we have to go to sleep? Can we just stay like this for a while?
All night long, if you want. We'll tell our secrets to the dark.
Okay.
So let's hear another one of your irrational fears. Mia grasped me by the arms and pulled herself into my chest, like she was burrowing her body into mine.
I'm scared of losing you,
she said in the faintest of voices. I pushed her away so I could see her face and kiss the top of her forehead. I said irrational fears, because that's not gonna happen.
It still scares me,
she murmured. But then she went on to list other random things that freaked her out, and I did the same. And we kept whispering to each other, telling stories from our childhoods, deep, deep into the night, until finally Mia forgot to be scared and fell asleep. The weather turned cool a few weeks later, and that winter was when Mia had her accident. So that actually turned out to be the last time I went camping. But even if it weren't, I still think it would be the best trip of my life. Whenever I remember it, I just picture our tent, a little ship glowing in the night, the sounds of Mia's and my whispers escaping like musical notes, floating out on a moonlit sea. Chapter 16. You crossed the water, left me ashore. It killed me enough, but you wanted more. You blew up the bridge. A mad terrorist waved from your side, threw me a kiss. I started to follow, but realized too late. There was nothing but air underneath my feet. Bridge. Collateral damage, track 4. Fingers of light are starting to pry open the night sky. Soon the sun will rise, and a new day will inarguably begin. A day in which I'm leaving for London, and Mia for Tokyo. I feel the countdown of the clock ticking like a time bomb. We're on the Brooklyn Bridge now, and though Mia hasn't said so specifically, I feel like this must be the last stop. I mean, we're leaving Manhattan, and not a round trip like our cruise out to Staten Island and back was. And also, Mia has decided, I guess, that since she's pulled some confessionals, it's my turn. About halfway across the bridge, she stops suddenly and turns to me.
So what's up with you and the band?
She asks. There's a warm wind blowing, but I suddenly feel cold. What do you mean, what's up? Mia shrugs.
Something's up. I can tell. You've hardly talked about them all night. You guys used to be inseparable, and now you don't even live in the same state. And why didn't you go to London together?
I told you, logistics.
What was so important that they couldn't have waited one night for you?
I had to do some stuff. Go into the studio and lay down a few guitar tracks. Mia eyes me skeptically.
But you're on tour for a new album. Why are you even recording?
A promo version of one of our singles. More of this, I say, frowning as I rub my fingers together in a money-money motion.
But wouldn't you be recording together?
I shake my head. It doesn't really work like that anymore. And besides, I had to do an interview with Shuffle.
An interview? Not with the band, just with you? That's what I don't get.
I think back to the day before, to Vanessa LeGrand, and out of the blue I'm recalling the lyrics to Bridge, and wondering if maybe discussing this with Mia Hall above the dark waters of the East River isn't such a hot idea. At least it isn't Friday the 13th anymore.
Yeah, that's kind of how it works these days, too, I say.
Why do they only want just you? What do they want to know about?
I really don't want to talk about this, but Mia's like a bloodhound, tracking a scent, and I know her well enough to know that I can either throw her a piece of bloody meat or let her sniff her way to the real pile of stinking corpses. I go for the diversion. Actually, that part's kind of interesting. The reporter, she asked about you.
What?
Mia swivels around to face me. She was interviewing me and asked about you. About us, about high school. The look of shock on Mia's face, I savor it. I think about what she said earlier, about her life in Oregon being a lifetime ago. Well, maybe not such a lifetime ago. That's the first time that's happened. Kind of strange coincidence, all things considered.
I don't believe in coincidences anymore.
I didn't tell her anything, but she'd gotten a hold of the old Cougar yearbook, the one with our picture, Groovy and the Geek. Mia shakes her head.
Yeah, I so love that nickname.
Don't worry, I didn't say anything. And for good measure, I smashed her recorder, destroyed all evidence.
Not all the evidence, she stares at me. The cougar lives on. I'm sure Kim will be delighted to know her early work may turn up in a national magazine.
She shakes her head and chuckles.
Once Kim gets you in her shutter, you're stuck forever. So it was pointless to destroy that reporter's recorder.
I know. I just sort of lost it. She was this very provocative person, and she was trying to get a rise out of me with all these insults disguised as compliments. Mia nods knowingly.
I get that, too. It's the worst. I was fascinated by the Shostakovich you played tonight. So much more subdued than the Bach, she says in a snooty voice. Translation, the Shostakovich sucked.
I can't imagine the Shostakovich ever sucking, but I won't deny us this common ground.
So what did she want to know about me?
She had plans to do this big expose, I guess, on what makes Shooting Star tick. And she went digging around our hometown and talked to people we went to high school with. And they told her about us. About what we were. And about you and what happened. I trail off. I look down at the river, at a passing barge, which, judging by its smell, is carrying garbage.
And what really happened?
Mia asks. I'm not sure if this is a rhetorical question, so I force my own voice into a jokey drawl. Yeah, that's what I'm still trying to figure out. It occurs to me that this is maybe the most honest thing I've said all night, but the way I've said it transforms it into a lie.
You know, my manager warned me that the accident might get a lot of attention as my profile went up, but I didn't think that the connection to you would be an issue. I mean, I did in the beginning. I sort of waited for someone to look me up, ghosts of girlfriends past. But I guess I wasn't interesting enough compared to your other, attachments.
She thinks that's why none of the hacks have pestered her? Because she's not as interesting as Bryn, who I guess she does know about? If only she knew how the band's inner circle has bent over backward to keep her name out of things, to not touch the bruise that blooms at the mere mention of her. That right at this very moment, there are riders in interview contracts that dictate whole swaths of forbidden conversational topics that, though they don't name her specifically, are all about obliterating her from the record, protecting her and me.
I guess high school really is ancient history,
she concludes. Ancient history? Have you really relegated us to the trash heap of the dumb high school romance? And if that's the case, why the hell can't I do the same?
Yeah, well, you plus me, we're like MTV plus Lifetime, I say, with as much jauntiness as I can muster.
In other words, shark bait.
She sighs. Oh, well, I suppose even sharks have to eat.
What's that supposed to mean?
It's just, I don't particularly want my family history dragged through the public eye, but if that's the price to be paid for doing what you love, I guess I'll pay it.
And we're back to this. The notion that music can make it all worthwhile. I'd like to believe. I just don't. I'm not even sure that I ever did. It isn't the music that makes me want to wake up every day and take another breath. I turn away from her toward the dark water below. What if it's not what you love? I mumble, but my voice gets lost in the wind and the traffic. But at least I've said it out loud. I've done that much.
I need a cigarette. I lean against the railing and look uptown toward a trio of bridges. Mia comes to stand beside me as I'm fumbling to get my lighter to work.
You should quit,
she says, touching me gently on the shoulder. For a second, I think she means the band, that she heard what I said before and is telling me to quit Shooting Star, leave the whole music industry. I keep waiting for someone to advise me to quit the music business, but no one ever does. Then I remember how earlier tonight she told me the same thing, right before she bummed a cigarette. It's not so easy, I say.
Bullshit,
Mia says, with a self-righteousness that instantly recalls her mother, Kat, who wore her certitude like a beat-up leather jacket and who had a mouth on her that could make a roadie blush.
Quitting's not hard. Deciding to quit is hard. Once you make that mental leap, the rest is easy.
Really? Was that how you quit me? And just like that, without thinking, without saying it in my head first, without arguing with myself for days, it's out there.
So,
she says, as if speaking to an audience under the bridge,
he finally says it.
Was I not supposed to? Am I just supposed to let this whole night go without talking about what you did?
No,
she says softly. So why? Why did you go? Was it because of the voices? She shakes her head.
It wasn't the voices.
Then what? What was it? I hear the desperation in my own voice now.
It was lots of things, like how you couldn't be yourself around me.
What are you talking about?
You stopped talking to me.
That's absurd, Mia. I talk to you all the time.
You talked to me, but you didn't. I could see you having these two-sided conversations, the things you wanted to say to me, and the words that actually came out.
I think of all the dual conversations I have with everyone. Is that when it started? Well, you weren't exactly easy to talk to, I shoot back. Anything I said was the wrong thing. She looks at me with a sad smile.
I know. It wasn't just you. It was you plus me. It was us.
I just shake my head. It's not true.
Yes, it is. But don't feel bad. Everyone walked on eggshells around me. But with you, it was painful that you couldn't be real with me. I mean, you barely even touched me.
As if to reinforce the point, she places two fingers on the inside of my wrist. Were smoke to rise and the imprints of her two fingers branded onto me, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. I have to pull away just to steady myself.
You were healing, is my pathetic reply. And if I recall, when we did try, you freaked.
Once, she says.
Once. All I wanted was for you to be okay. All I wanted was to help you. I would have done anything.
She drops her chin to her chest.
Yes, I know. You wanted to rescue me.
Damn, Mia, you say that like it's a bad thing. She looks up at me. The sympathy is still in her eyes, but there's something else now, too. A fierceness. It slices up my anger and reconstitutes it as dread.
You were so busy trying to be my savior that you left me all alone, she says. I know you were trying to help, but it just felt, at the time, like you were pushing me away. Keeping things from me for my own good and making me more of a victim. Ernesto says that people's good intentions can wind up putting us in boxes as confining as coffins.
Ernesto? What the hell does he know about it? Mia traces the gap between the wooden boardwalk planks with her toe.
A lot, actually. His parents were killed when he was 8. He was raised by his grandparents.
I know what I'm supposed to feel is sympathy, but the rage just washes over me. What? Is there some club? I ask, my voice starting to crack. A grief club that I can't join? I expect her to tell me no, or that I'm a member. After all, I lost them too. Except even back then, it had been different, like there'd been a barrier. That's the thing you never expect about grieving, what a competition it is. Because no matter how important they'd been to me, no matter how sorry people told me they were, Denny and Kat and Teddy weren't my family. And suddenly that distinction had mattered. Apparently it still does, because Mia stops and considers my question.
Maybe not a grief club, but a guilt club, from being left behind.
Oh, don't talk to me about guilt. My blood runs thick with it. On the bridge, now I feel tears coming. The only way to keep them at bay is to find the anger that sustained me and push back with it.
But you could have at least told me,
I say, my voice rising to a shout.
Instead of dropping me like a one-night stand, you could have had the decency to break up with me instead of leaving me wondering for 3 years.
I didn't plan it, she says, her own pitch rising.
I didn't get on that plane thinking we'd split up. You were everything to me. Even as it was happening, I didn't believe it was happening. But it was. Just being here, being away. It was all so much easier in a way I didn't anticipate. In a way I didn't think my life could be anymore. It was a huge relief.
I think of all the girls whose backs I couldn't wait to see in retreat. How once their sound and smell and voices were gone, I felt my whole body exhale. A lot of the time, Bryn falls into this category. That's how my absence felt to Mia.
I planned to tell you,
she continues, the words coming out in a breathless jumble now.
But at first I was so confused. I didn't even know what was happening, only that I was feeling better without you. And how could I explain that to you? And then time went by. You didn't call me. When you didn't pursue it, I just figured that you of all people, you understood. I knew I was being a chicken shit, but I thought...
Mia stumbles for a second, then regains her composure.
I thought I was allowed that, and that you understood it. I mean, you seem to. You wrote, she says I have to pick, choose you or choose me. She's the last one standing. I don't know. When I heard roulette, I just thought you did understand, that you were angry, but you knew. I had to choose me.
That's your excuse for dropping me without a word? There's cowardly Mia, and then there's cruel. Is that who you've become?
Maybe it was who I needed to be for a while, she cries. And I'm sorry. I know I should have contacted you, should have explained, but you weren't all that accessible.
Oh, bullshit, Mia. I'm inaccessible to most people, but you? 2 phone calls and you could have tracked me down.
It didn't feel that way, she said. You were this...
She trails off, miming an explosion, the same as Vanessa LeGrand had done earlier in the day.
Phenomenon. Not a person anymore.
That's such a load of crap and you should know it. And besides, that was more than a year after you left. A year! A year in which I was curled up into a ball of misery at my parents' house, Mia. Or did you forget that phone number too?
No.
Mia's voice is flat.
But I couldn't call you at first.
Why?
I yell.
Why not? Mia faces me now. The wind is whipping her hair this way and that, so she looks like some kind of mystical sorceress. Beautiful, powerful, and scary at the same time. She shakes her head and starts to turn away. Oh no, we've come this far over the bridge. She can blow the damn thing up if she wants to, but not without telling me everything. I grab her, turn her to face me.
Why not? Tell me, you owe me this!
She looks at me, square in the eye, taking aim, and then she pulls the trigger.
Because I hated you.
The wind, the noise, it all just goes quiet for a second. And I'm left with a dull ringing in my ear, like after a show, like after a heart monitor goes to flatline.
Hated me? Why?
You made me stay. She says it quietly, and it almost gets lost in the wind and the traffic, and I'm not sure I heard her. But then she repeats it louder this time.
You made me stay!
And there it is. A hollow blown through my heart, confirming what some part of me has always known. She knows. The electricity in the air has changed. It's like you can smell the ions dancing.
I still wake up every single morning and for a second I forget that I don't have my family anymore,
she tells me.
And then I remember. Do you know what that's like? Over and over again? It would have been so much easier.
And suddenly her calm facade cracks and she begins to cry. Please, I hold up my hands. Please don't.
No, you're right. You have to let me say this, Adam. You have to hear it. It would have been easier to die. It's not that I want to be dead now. I don't. I have a lot in my life that I get satisfaction from, that I love. But some days, especially in the beginning, it was so hard.
And I couldn't help but think that it would have been so much simpler to go with the rest of them. But you asked me to stay. You begged me to stay. You stood over me and you made a promise to me as sacred as any vow. And I can understand why you're angry, but you can't blame me. You can't hate me for taking your word.
Mia's sobbing now. I'm racked with shame because I brought her to this. And suddenly, I get it. I understand why she summoned me to her at the theater, why she came after me once I left her dressing room. This is what the farewell tour is really all about. Mia completing the severance she began 3 years ago. Letting go. Everyone talks about it like it's the easiest thing. Unfurl your fingers one by one until your hand is open. But my hand has been clenched into a fist for 3 years now. It's frozen shut. All of me is frozen shut, and about to shut down completely. I stare down at the water. A minute ago it was calm and glassy, but now it's like the river is opening up, churning, a violent whirlpool. It's that vortex, threatening to swallow me whole. I'm going to drown in it, with nobody. Nobody in the murk with me. I've blamed her for all of this, for leaving, for ruining me. Maybe that was the seed of it. But from that one little seed grew this tumor of a flowering plant. And I'm the one who nurtures it. I water it. I care for it. I nibble from its poison berries. I let it wrap around my neck, choking the air right out of me. I've done that. All by myself. All to myself. I look at the river. It's like the waves are 50 feet high, snapping at me now, trying to pull me over the bridge into the waters below.
I can't do this anymore!
I yell as the carnivorous waves come for me. Again, I scream.
I can't do this anymore!
I'm yelling to the waves and to Liz and Fitzy and Mike and Aldous, to our record executives and to Bryn and Vanessa and the paparazzi and the girls in the U-Mish sweatshirts and the scenesters on the subway and everyone who wants a piece of me when there aren't enough pieces to go around. But mostly, I'm yelling it to myself.
I can't do this anymore!
I scream louder than I've ever screamed in my life. So loud my breath is knocking down trees in Manhattan, I'm sure of it. And as I battle with invisible waves and imaginary vortexes and demons that are all too real and of my own making, I actually feel something in my chest open. A feeling so intense, it's like my heart's about to burst. And I just let it. I just let it out. When I look up, the river is a river again. My hands, which have been gripping the railing of the bridge so tight that my knuckles had gone white, have loosened. Mia is walking away, walking toward the other end of the bridge, without me. I get it now. I have to make good on my promise, to let her go, to really let her go, to let us both go. Chapter 17. I started playing in my first band, Infinity 89, when I was 14 years old. Our first show was at a house party near the college campus. All three of us in the band, me on guitar, my friend Nate on bass, and his older brother Jonah on drums, sucked. None of us had been playing for long, and after the gig, we found out that Jonah had bribed the host of the party to let us play. It's a little-known fact that Adam Wilde's first foray into playing rock music in front of an audience might never have happened had Jonah Hamilton not pitched in for a keg. The keg turned out to be the best thing about that show. We were so nervous that we turned the amps up too loud, creating a frenzy of feedback that made the neighbors complain, and then we overcompensated by playing so low that we couldn't hear one another's instruments. What I could hear in the pauses between songs was the sound of the party. The din of beer bottles clinking, of mindless chatter, of people laughing, and I swear, in the back room of the house, people watching American Idol. The point is, I could hear all this because our band was so crappy that no one bothered to acknowledge that we were playing. We weren't worth cheering. We were too bad to even boo. We were simply ignored. When we finished playing, the party carried on as if we'd never gone on. We got better. Never great, but better. Never good enough to play anything but house parties. Then Jonah went off to college, and Nate and I were left without a drummer, and that was the end of Infinity 89. Thus began my brief stint as a lone singer-songwriter about town,
playing in coffee houses mostly. Doing the cafe circuit was marginally better than the house parties. With just me and a guitar, I didn't need to up the volume that much, and people in the audience were mostly respectful. But as I played, I was still distracted by the sounds of things other than the music. The hiss of the cappuccino maker, the intellectual college students' hushed conversations about important things, the giggles of girls. After the show, the giggles grew louder as the girls came up to me to talk, to ask me about my inspiration, to offer me mixed CDs they'd made, and sometimes to offer other things. One girl was different. She had ropey, muscled arms and a fierce look in her eyes. The first time she spoke to me, she said only, "You're wasted." "Nope. Sober as a stone," I replied. "Not that kind of wasted," she said, arching her pierced eyebrow. "You're wasted on acoustic. I saw you play before in that terrible band of yours, but you were really good, even for a child such as yourself." "Thanks, I think." "You're welcome. I'm not here for flattery. I'm here for recruitment." "Sorry, I'm a pacifist." "Funny. I'm a dyke, one who likes to ask and tell. So, I'm also ill-suited for the military. No, I'm putting together a band. I think you're an outrageously talented guitar player, so I'm here to rob the cradle, artistically speaking."
I was barely 16 years old and a little bit intimidated by this ballsy chick, but I'd said, why not? "Who else is in the band?"
"Me on drums, you on guitar."
"And?"
"Those are the most important parts, don't you think? Fantastic drummers and singing guitar players don't grow on trees, not even in Oregon. Don't worry, I'll fill in the blanks. I'm Liz, by the way."
She stuck out her hand. It was crusted with calluses, always a good sign on a drummer. Within a month, Liz had drafted Fitzy and Mike, and we'd christened ourselves Shooting Star and started writing songs together. A month after that, we had our first gig. It was another house party, but nothing like the ones I'd played with Infinity 89. Right from the get-go, something was different. When I slashed out my first chord, it was like turning off a light. Everything just fell silent. We had people's attention, and we kept it. In the empty space between songs, people cheered and then got quiet, anticipating our next song. Over time, they'd start shouting requests. After a while, they got to know our lyrics so well that they'd sing along, which was handy when I spaced the lyric. Pretty soon, we moved on to playing in bigger clubs. I could sometimes make out bar sounds in the background, the clink of glasses, the shouts of orders to a bartender. I also started to hear people scream my name for the first time.
"Adam! Over here!"
A lot of those voices belonged to girls. The girls I mostly ignored. At this point, I'd started obsessing about a girl who never came to our shows, but who I'd seen playing cello at school. And when Mia had become my girlfriend, and then started coming to my shows, and, to my surprise, seemed to actually enjoy, if not the gigs, then at least our music, I sometimes listened for her. I wanted to hear her voice calling out my name, even though I knew that was something she'd never do. She was a reluctant plus one. She tended to hang backstage and watch me with a solemn intensity. Even when she loosened up enough to sometimes watch the show like a normal person from the audience, she remained pretty reserved. But still, I listened for the sound of her voice. It never seemed to matter that I didn't hear it. Listening for her was half the fun. As the band got bigger and the shows got bigger, the cheers just grew louder. And then for a while, it all went quiet. There was no music, no band, no fans, no Mia. When it came back, the music, the gigs, the crowds, it all sounded different. Even during that 2-week tour right on the heels of Collateral Damage's release, I could tell how much had changed just by how different everything sounded. The wall of sound as we played enveloped the band, almost as if we were playing in a bubble made of nothing other than our own noise. And in between the songs, there was this screaming and shrieking. Soon, much sooner than I ever could have imagined, we were playing these enormous venues, arenas and stadiums, to more than 15,000 fans. At these venues, there are just so many people and so much sound that it's almost impossible to differentiate a specific voice. All I hear, aside from our own instruments now blaring out of the most powerful speakers available, is that wild scream from the crowd when we're backstage and the lights go down right before we go out. And once we're on stage, the constant shrieking of the crowd melds so it sounds like the furious howl of a hurricane.
Some nights I swear I can feel the breath of those 15,000 screams. I don't like this sound. I find the monolithic nature of it disorienting.